Alcoholic.
Hi, Carrie.
Yes, we were in the same profession, but I think I teach in a different world than you did.
Oh, my God, yes.
You know, it's amazing. I listen to the people that I work with, and I could probably set aside half the room for my coworkers. Like I said, I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1989. But by the grace of God, I just celebrated 25 years of sobriety. You know, and it's not... you know, I talk to my husband, who we discuss this all the time, and you know, I don't think that's quite impressive, because I look at quality, not quantity. I may not have taken a drink, but I certainly didn't do things the way you're supposed to. We'll get to that. I have to center myself. I haven't been home yet. I went straight from work to the doctor to Walmart to here, and yeah, holy cow. But the Easter Bunny's done shopping. That was my mission today. Okay. I grew up out in West County, out in Girard, and I came from an extremely dysfunctional home. Alcoholism, I heard it once said, and the lead doesn't run in my family, it gallops. And I really could relate to that, because when I was growing up, it was everywhere. It was everywhere. It was on both sides of my family. My dad's actually been sober for a few years longer than me. And, you know, my circumstances didn't make me an alcoholic. Okay, I am a firm believer that it's genetic, and I'm at the point in my life right now where I can say that I was the one of the three children that was blessed with this disease, and it took me a really, really, really long time to say that. But you know, I look at my life today, and I look at where I've been, and how far I've come, and I don't know how normal people deal with life without a program of recovery behind them. You know, and I've had my issues, and we've had our problems, and you know, thank God for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have to live them every single day of my life, or I wouldn't be standing up here. I'd be hanging out with my coworkers. So I grew up in Girard, and like I said, it was a very dysfunctional home. But I didn't know that. You know, that was just life. I had nothing to compare it to until I was about 7 years old, and I made a friend. And I got to, you know, you're in school and you go over to your friend's house. And, you know, I went over to my friend's house, and she lived on this farm in the valley. And it was a really cool place to be, you know. And I began to notice things, that maybe my life wasn't as normal as I thought it was. Because when I went over to this house, you know, the atmosphere was completely different. They smiled. They laughed. They said, "I love you." They hugged. And that was my first clue that what I had, you know, known was maybe not normal. So I began to spend more and more time down on this farm with my friend. And we got to the point where I was calling her mom and dad, mom and dad. And I used to lay in bed at night and wonder, why isn't my life like that? Why aren't my parents like that? And I just tucked that information in the back of my head. And that was the very beginning of the whole square peg in the round hole. And I was beginning to feel quite square. And, you know, time went on, and I spent more and more time down on that farm, running through the woods and just doing all sorts of fun things. And, you know, one day this guy that I called Dad, he showed up at my door, but he wasn't there to see me, you know, and he was there to see my dad. And, you know, story be told, you know, Buzz became my dad's first sponsor. And, you know, I joke with him about that, and I always say, I knew your sponsor before you did, and, you know. But in this 10-year-old mind of mine, now that Dad's not drinking, my house should be like their house. And it wasn't. It wasn't. It actually got worse. So then I started to think it must be me. You know, I must be the reason that this family's not, you know, as they say now, happy, joyous, and free. And again, we take that information and we tuck it back in that little box, that little tape recorder that plays over and over again, going, you're different, something's wrong with you. And then I took a drink. And, you know, that I'd convinced myself that I was the defective one, that there was something wrong with me. And it was amazing. I took a drink, and all that ugliness melted away. All the fear, all the anxiety. I took a drink, and I didn't give a crap what you thought about me, what you thought about my family. It was a freedom that I had never imagined. It was a freedom that I never thought I would ever be able to imagine. So my first drink was around 12. Or I thought 14, my mom said 12. She has a black belt in Al-Anon. I don't argue with her anymore. But my first drunk, I was 16, and I just wanted to silence the negativity in the voices. Not that I heard voices. I didn't hear voices, but I heard my own voice. But when I drank, it was gone. When I drank, there was a peace. And it, of course, now mind you, that peace didn't last much longer than the first drink. But there was a peace. And I thought, well, if one drink's good, two drinks will be better. Three drinks would be fabulous. Why not just finish the bottle? And I only weighed about 90 pounds. And if you drink a magnum of Rioniti Red, it does bad things to you. My first drunk, my first puking my guts out, my first blackout. But I loved it, you know? I loved it. You know, I was 16 at the time. And those of you that do know my father, we're a little bit alike. Smidgen. And he got sober. He didn't get happy, and I hated him for that. And he wasn't too fond of me at that point. Not too many people were very fond of me. I didn't even get invited to my 5-year class reunion. That's how bad it was. They didn't even want me there. So we didn't get along very well. And of course, my parents didn't get along very well. Dad was out of town when my first little escapade. So my punishment was, I ran cross country and there was a meet the very next morning. My punishment was, you either get up and run that race or I tell your father. I got up and ran the race because that was the least painful of the two. And it was It was the longest 2.75 miles of my life. And I still can't smell Rioniti without gagging. And that became the routine. You know, but you know, blackouts, I didn't know that until I got sober that they had a name. I thought everybody forgot what they did and woke up with bruises all over their body and couldn't explain it or can't. It became a joke to me because that would be the conversation the following day was, what did Carrie do? What did she do? And it was just, but I thought that was normal. I mean, I had nothing to compare it to. I thought that happened to everybody. I didn't know. So I did my thing. And I did my thing all the time because when I wasn't doing my thing, the ugliness came back, and the self-loathing I couldn't stop what was going on inside my head. I thought I was nuts, and drinking was the only thing that took that away. Now, I do believe I was a full-blown alcoholic by the age of 18. I didn't drink every day, but when I did drink, there was no other reason to pick up a drink than to get shit-faced. Excuse my language. I'm sorry, Steph. It's been a really long day. It really has been. And now, when you're that age, the consequences, I can tell you right now, in the mid-80s, the underage drinking fine was $68.50. And for some reason, that I will never forget that number. I don't know why. Probably because I wrote that check many, many, many times. I lived next door to the chief of police in Lake City, which I always thought it was a good thing, but it really wasn't because they were some of my biggest enablers. Because they knew me. They parked the car there. They didn't have, you know, a police station, you know. I knew them all. So they would find me, take my beer, and send me home. Don't do it again. Go straight home. And then, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay, you know. I won't. I promise. And then I would get up the next morning, and they would be sitting on the chief's back patio drinking my beer and smiling and waving. And that was, like, worse than anything. Did I drive drunk? Absolutely. And that scares the crap out of me. I drove in blackouts. It meant nothing. I could care less. See, by that point, I had convinced myself, because I was so stinking miserable, that I was going to be dead by the age of 21. So who cares? Not thinking of what I was doing to my family, not thinking of what I could possibly do to another individual, I didn't care. Because when I was drinking, the craziness was not there. It was when I wasn't drinking that the craziness came back immediately. So I drank as often as I could. I did manage to graduate high school, and not quite sure how I did that, but I did. And the question was posed to me, where are you going to college? Not, gee, do you want to go to college? No, where are you going? And I think that was just because they were done. They were done. You know, the 3 a.m. phone calls from the Mill Creek Police Department. You know, I look at, see, I have a 21-year-old stepson. And I can't imagine what my parents went through. cannot even imagine. Because some of the crap that kid's pulled was nothing compared to what I did. He just gets caught more often. I don't know what. He needs to be smarter about what he's doing. So I went to college. I went to Clarion. And I say this every lead. You know, I'd love to tell you about Clarion. I spent 2.5 years in Clarion. I don't remember Clarion. That was a very ugly period of time for me. And, you know, I joke about it. I always say I wanted to call the student loan people and ask them if I really had to pay for 2.5 years of school. I don't remember. And it got very ugly very quickly. And, you know, I used to lay in bed, and I still do. I try really hard to remember Clarion. And I can't. I know I lived in a co-ed dorm that was right next to a bar. I think it was the Stallion or something like that. And I know I did not live with the same people more than one semester at a time, and I always thought that was because I had a poor choice of roommates. And I laugh about it now, but there was nothing funny about it. We gravitate towards the people that drink like we do. And then we start to gravitate towards the people that are worse than we are in our minds. I was raised Catholic, but I wasn't what you would consider a good Catholic girl. I got what I wanted when I wanted it. I was the type of drunk that would go to a bar and come home with more money and lighters than I left with. And it was almost like Christmas. You know, I'd get up in the morning and empty my pockets, and it would just be like, I woke up one morning with a whole roll of the Clarion News. I must have found it on my way home and thought it was really cool and brought it with me. So I had like 24 copies of the Clarion newspaper, and I didn't know why. You know, I laugh, but you know, there are bits and pieces that I do remember that are really nothing to laugh about. And I have dealt with that, and it took me a long time to deal with that. I'm not that person. You know, I heard it, you know, they say, you know, I'm not a bad person trying to be good. I was the sick person trying to get well. And that was what it was. I was sick. When things got really bad in Clarion, I thought, and you know, the geographical cure. I learned all of this after the fact, okay? I just needed to get out of Clarion because I was in a little bit of trouble. I had made a few enemies, and, you know, my mom needed me closer to home. So I transferred to Edinburgh. Yeah, mom needed me closer to home. No. So I brought my whopping 1.6 grade point average, and I went to Edinburgh. Now, and I'm not even 21 yet, by the way. I turned 21 the day before classes started, and this was a very significant day for me, okay? Number one, it was the day I've been waiting for since birth, because then nobody could tell me what to do. And it was also the day that I had convinced myself that my life was going to end anyways. So when I turned 21, all hell broke loose. It was because I was such an angry, miserable person, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. Never once did it occur to me that maybe I was drinking a little too much, because I grew up around these rooms. I was a graduate of Alateen, for goodness sakes. My picture of an alcoholic were those old people that would be in my living room on a Saturday night playing charades and drinking Pepsi. Those were the people that, you know, my dad and Buzz and TJ and Ike. But so I had this, and it's not, I mean, for goodness sakes, I was 21 years old and I'm a girl, and I know all about this AA's. I considered myself an AA expert because I went to Alateen. I used to go to the conference when it was at the, what was it, the Hilton downtown. It had the pool on the second floor, and we'd have a little dance party. And but the only reason I went to Alateen, to be, because this is like an honest program, was because it was anonymous and I could smoke there and nobody was allowed to tell my mother. And so I did. I would go every week, and you know, I want you to understand that I try not, I mean, I make light of it now, but I was in so much pain. I can't even express the amount of pain that I was in. I had, I felt I had nowhere to go, nothing, nowhere to turn. I didn't know what to do. And that's why, you know, I had said, you know, I wanted to be dead because I had nowhere else to go. I had nowhere to, I was just so stinking miserable and ugly and angry, and, you know, I can't even, I mean, it's hard for me to express, you know. So, on a beautiful spring day in March, I had been sick. I mean, I honestly think I was actually sick. I mean, I actually like had the flu for like a week. And you know, the first day I felt like, you know, I felt better. The I was engaged at the time. We were in love. Because I found somebody that could drink like I did. I said, let's go for a walk. It was like noon, you know? And I said, you know, so I grabbed my driver's license and my money, and he said, what do you need that for? I said, well, maybe we'll stop for ice cream. And the hotel bar does not serve ice cream, because that's where we ended up. And by, I was, and I'm estimating about 5:30, I was cordially asked to leave the bar, which in the 2.5 months that I drank, happened a lot. I wasn't very big, size-wise, but my mouth got me in an awful lot of trouble. And I was one of those people that would like to start the trouble and then just fade back and watch it happen. And I did that a lot. And so here I am in the hotel bar, and I'm shooting pool with some guy I'd never met before. Why? Because he's buying the beer. And the guy that I'm engaged to is sitting in a booth by himself. And I saw absolutely nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. Well, I was asked to leave, and of course, I didn't go cheerfully. I never went anywhere cheerfully. And so the guy that I was with dragged me out dragged me out of the bar. I think we were wrestling on the sidewalk in the front or something. So I got up and started walking home. And then something happened, you know. And I've heard it explained, it's that moment where God paralyzes the liar long enough for you to see the truth. And I was standing in front of Burger King on Main Street or whatever they call that. And I started to cry. That's one moment that I pray and never forget. Because I knew. And it was at that moment that I realized I didn't want to die. I didn't. Wasn't quite sure what I had to live for, but I didn't want to die. So we went back to my apartment, and I said, I need to call my dad. My dad was out of town. He was in Indiana at the time. I don't even know what time it is. Holy cow. All right. And so, of course, I call my mother, and I was a professional liar at that point. A cheat and a thief, too, by the way, if you haven't figured that out. And I don't even remember what I told her, but I needed Dad's phone number. And because I didn't much like that woman anymore, so I didn't want her to know anything. You have to understand, though, there's that line in the sand, and I was not about to step over that line, but I knew I was desperate. So I called Dad, and I'm a drunk, blubbering, crying idiot, and all I could get out was, I'm afraid of what I think I might be. And there was dead silence. And my first thought was, that son of a bitch hung up on me. And we've talked, I mean, of course we've talked over the years about that night. And he said all he could do was hit his knees. You know, and I didn't realize until many years later the amount of pain that I caused and the amount of prayers that got me here. So I said, I'm afraid of what I think I might be. And because I knew the rules. I knew the rules. You say you're an alcoholic, you're never allowed to drink again. I knew the rules because I went to Alateen. Uh-huh. And so he said, hey, stay right there, give the phone to Gary. That was that goofball's name. And apparently he told Gary that if he had to, he was to physically restrain me from leaving. Because as quick as that first epiphany came, he knew me better than I knew myself, that there could be another one right behind it that would say, what are you, friggin' crazy? And I would be gone. And he knew that. So the phone rings here. I'm not even 100% sure of the sequence of events. All I know is I was told to go stand out on the side of the road and that someone would be there. And now... I just moved to Edinburgh. I wasn't quite sure of anything. And thank God Bert Miller was the first guy to pull up and say, get in. Because I had no idea what he looked like, and I would have got into anybody's car that pulled up and said, get in. And who knows where I would have ended up. And so Bert Miller and Pam Ryan 12-stepped me. And the only thing, and I remember what Pam's coffee table looked like, because I sat on her couch and never took my eyes off the coffee table. I don't know what they said. I have no idea. But I do know, and if you ask them, they will tell you, that all I said over and over and over was, I'm afraid of what I think I might be. They said that, and if you ask Bertha, he'll tell you. And they still laugh about that. That's all I said. I don't remember going home. I don't remember anything. I remember Pam's coffee table, and that's all I remember. They must have said something right, because I ended up at a meeting the next day. And it was the Wednesday Scots group, and it was at noon on campus. And I woke up and thought, what have you done? But I know the rules, and I didn't say the A word and my name. So, not that A word. I always said that A word and my name. Because you have to understand, at this point in my life, I have considered myself a complete failure at everything I have ever attempted. I was a failure at a daughter. I was a failure as, I didn't have any friends, so I couldn't even be a failure at that. I was a failure at school. I was a failure as a runner, and because I ran for a really long time, and my priorities got a little out of whack. I was probably the only runner at the state cross country meet, sneaking around the edge of the hotel to have a cigarette. I was a failure at it. I was a failure, and that was in my own mind. So if I said that word with my name and then I drank again, that would just be added to the list of failures. So I went to this meeting and I, like I said, I knew the rules and I knew, and I was scared. I was scared because I didn't want to be one of them old people sitting on my mom and dad's couch playing charades and drinking Pepsi. So I walked into this meeting, and I'd have to tell this because... So I go into this meeting, and if you go down this little hallway and you go into this room, and I walked into this room. Now, mind you, I didn't know anybody, really. And all along this wall over here, and I can picture it like it was yesterday, is tables like this lined up, and they just had covered with food and salads and sandwiches and cakes and cookies and coffee. And then I looked down this wall, and there's tables lined up with men. And I thought, my two favorite things in the whole wide world, I have arrived. I'm going to hang out here for a while. I got food, I got men. It was like an epiphany, because there wasn't any old people drinking coffee and playing charades. It was... Wow. So I stuck around. Now, I don't remember. I hear people get up to the podium and they say, well, so-and-so spoke at my first lead, and he said, and she said, and they said, and he did this. And Fred can even tell you on his first meeting who was sitting around the damn table. I'm like, I don't remember a thing. I've been told I sat in the back and cried the whole time. I remember nothing. It was around, I think it was a round-robin meeting or something. But there was food and there was men. I thought, that's pretty cool. I wonder what... So I went to another meeting. And there was cake and cookies and men. And so I kept going to meetings. I thought, this AA thing's not too bad. It's not like what I thought. It's changed over the years. And so I stuck around. And I went to meetings. And I ate cake and smiled and nodded and clapped when you were supposed to. And I knew all the prayers because I was Catholic. And so I would go to, it was a Tuesday night in Crossingville, and I don't think that meeting is there anymore.
No, it's not.
And, oh my God, I love that meeting.
Hooterville.
Love that meeting. And I used to, because I would get rides out there because I was in college and I didn't have a car. And they had this chip system. And you would get a chip when you introduced. And then at 30 days, you would trade it in for another chip. And then at 60 days and 90 days, and then you trade it in. And I wanted one of those chips so stinking bad. But I knew the rules. And so I just ate cake and smiled and nodded and thought, well, it's just a chip. I can live without the chip. And I couldn't. I was 21. I was a girl. I was in college. And I'm not supposed to be an alcoholic. It's not supposed to be like that. Okay. So I'm sitting there, and I had Pam on one side and Lonnie, I don't know if anybody remembers Lonnie, on the other side of me, and they were bigger than me. And so I'm smiling, and I'm eating my cake, and I'm drinking my coffee, and they start the meeting, and I'm actually getting pretty good. I can, like, mouth the words to the steps and everything. And then they ask for new members. Now, I had been around for a while, and I thought I was pretty stealth. I was under the radar. Nobody noticed. And I did find out when you stop drinking, you do have some semblance of intelligence. And I was doing really well in school, and I thought, well, I can figure this out. It can't be that hard. And then Lonnie grabbed a hold of my thigh, and she started to squeeze. And it hurt. And she said, if you don't stand up and introduce yourself, I'm taking you out in the parking lot and kicking the shit out of you. And I shot out of that chair. And I said, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. I introduced because I was afraid. But, oh my God, you only had to spend 30 seconds with me to know. And I'm always the last to know these things. But all joking aside, you know, I said that. I broke the rules. I said it. And there was no bells, no whistles, no cake, balloons, nothing. But there was an instant where there was just this, I can't even, it was hope. And I had never felt that before. And it was just in that moment. And then I got my chip. And I'll tell you what. Wow. Because everybody knew. I wasn't kidding anybody. I wasn't. But I tell you that with that one moment of hope. And I would like to say that after that moment, that I did everything that you folks told me to do, and then some, and life was awesome, and that would be a lie. Now, they gave me a big book at one of the meetings, and they wrote on the inside cover, and I still have it. They wrote on the inside cover, read page 449. Well, I can follow directions, because I'm pretty smart. So I read page 449. I opened up the book, read page 449, went, that's nice, and I closed the book and put it on a shelf. And that's all I did. Every once in a while, someone would say, geez, you know, you really should work the steps. Like, really? And I got pretty good at justifying. And so I would go through the steps. Now, I'm here, so one's covered. Two and three, I'm Catholic. That's right. So, I mean, this is the way that this sick mind was thinking. And then I got to four, and I went, I'm Catholic. And because, you know, I'd gone to confession once or twice, and, you know, God knows what I did. I don't need to tell anybody else, so I checked that one off. And, you know, so I went through, and then I would get, well, I only want to do the odd steps because I don't like even numbers. And, you know, so I, you know, and I honestly didn't think that you folks actually did them because they sounded too easy. I thought it was just something that you read. I didn't think you actually did them. And so I didn't. And mm-hmm. life didn't get very good. Life didn't get very good because I had, I honestly believe that it was alcohol that did it to me. It wasn't me. It had nothing to do with me. I wasn't drinking. So everything should be fine. And as time went on, everything started to get really unfine. Really unfine. I graduated, and it was again suggested that I do the steps. And I gotta work. Okay? So I got a job, and when it was suggested again, I got another job, and I was working three jobs, and I really just don't have time for this. But you have to understand that as the years went on, not once did I sleep through the night. The nightmares were horrendous. And you know that VCR that we have in our brain that can replay over and over and over. And as time went on and the ugliness was creeping back, you know, there was a pride thing. And then there was also that thing that, you know, you people really do seem to kind of like me. And if you really knew what I was like, I was so afraid that you wouldn't like me anymore, because I spent so many years of my life worried about whether people liked me or whether I was accepted. And if you found out, you know, 7 years sober that I was a phony, that I was a fraud, and that I was an ugly, ugly, ugly human being, that you wouldn't like me anymore. And I couldn't deal with that. I finally felt like I belonged somewhere. And I couldn't... And I know that is just what was created up here. I know that, you know. And then I ran into a little bit of a health issue about 7 years sober. 8 years, I don't know. Even 9 years sober. And I was legally disabled for about 9 months, couldn't work. We had all sorts of therapies. You'd think one of them would have fixed me, but it didn't. It was a very ugly time in my life because I had been sober for a few days, and then God did this to me, and what more does he want from me, you know? It got to the point where I was praying and asking him why he didn't take me on that living room floor, you know? Why keep me around for this misery? So, but as stubborn and pig-headed as I was, I was still not ready to relent. And I figured there was only one other thing that I hadn't done yet that might help it. So I got married. I found somebody that I could fix because he was a little sicker than I was. And that didn't go very well. So I thought, well, there's only one other thing I haven't tried yet. So we had a baby. And, you know, 12 years sober, my marriage is falling apart. I'm living with my mother. I'm bartending. And, I was in a real bad place. I was in a real bad place. And I had another one of those epiphanies. And I'm standing behind the bar, and I can't shut the voices off anymore, and the misery is back. And I made arrangements, because of course you bartend, you meet people, and I made arrangements to, because I didn't want to drink, because that would be bad. So I made arrangements to get something else that maybe would help, and I'm standing behind the bar, and God intervened one more time, because that was a falling off point for me. And he paralyzed the liar in me long enough for me to see the truth, and I had to get the hell out of there, and I did. And my boss knew. He had always told me, if it ever gets to be too much, because he knew I was in recovery, sort of. And I told him it's too much, and I left. Now, I didn't know what else to do. I was desperate, and I remember sitting on my mother's stairs, just probably scaring the hell out of her because I was falling apart. And I picked up the phone and I called Eileen. Because I'd been bowling for years in the AA league, and you know, I had twisted everything and convinced myself that if I, you know, bowling I counted as a meeting because there was AAs there. If I saw one of you in the grocery store, I counted that as a meeting. I wasn't doing anything that you people had suggested, because I tend to overthink things, and you know, the meeting makers make it and do the steps and blah blah blah. And so I was 12 years sober, and I called Eileen, and she said, "I've been waiting for your call." Yeah. And, you know, I was prayed again. Prayed into not into the fellowship, but into sobriety. Because, you know, I was sober, but I wasn't sober. Not up here. So she said, "Meet me at the Wednesday night big book group." So I did. And, of course, fashionably late. See, I got into the point where I would go to a meeting and I would leave more irritated than when I got there. And I think it was simply because you folks were getting better and I was getting more and more miserable as the days went on. And I didn't know how to fix it. So I walk in and they're just hitting play on the Joe and Charlie tapes. And what does he start talking about? The fourth step. And once again, 12 years later, I sat in a meeting and cried through the entire thing. It was like deja vu. And Eileen said to me, "Are you done? Are you ready now?" And I said, "Yeah." I was beaten down. So I had gotten another, you know, I had a sponsor. If you're newer, don't get your friend to be your sponsor. It doesn't work. Because she'd say, "Do something," I'd say, "Screw you," and we'd go out and have fun. So I did my fourth step. And I tell you what, it took me 3 weeks, and I took the packet. I mean, I was an intellectual at this point, so I was going to do this, and I had it. And it was like the Holy Grail. And I finished it. It took me like 3.5 weeks. Really? And so I go over to her house to do my fifth step, and I walk in and I'm like, "It's done." And I was, you know, I had already planned I was going to get a shadow box and I was going to hang it on my living room wall. I mean, this thing took me 12 years to do. I was pretty damn proud of it. And so I, you know, da-da, you know. And she said, "Come on, let's go outside." And I said, "All right." So she takes my fourth step that I spent 12 years of my life preparing for and 3.5 weeks doing, and she put it on her charcoal grill and she lit it on fire. And I looked, honest to God, I wanted to punch her right in the face. I did. And her husband, who's also in this program, was watching out the kitchen window. I didn't know this. He tells me, he laughs about it now. He said, "I really thought it was like two of you going out and only one coming back." Because I'm like, "Do you realize, you know?" And she said, "You know, before you hit me, what do you see?" And I looked and I went, "I see smoke and ashes." And she said, "That's your past. Let it go." And up it went. And to this day, and I'm not, I haven't lost a minute of sleep over what went up in smoke and ash. Do I suggest to new people to do it my way? No. You know, this thing, one of those things you hear your mom and dad say when you're going to do as I say, not as I do. That's what I do. Do as I say. You know, and I used to, and it took me a while to get over the fact that I did it this way. You know, I used to bitch at Buzz, "You straightened out the road. You couldn't have straightened out the road before I put my car in the ditch at the top of the hill." You know, but he said something to me, you know, we were joking about that, and he said to me, he said, "If I would have straightened out that hill, you wouldn't be standing here where you're at right now." I'm a firm believer that, you know, everything that I've done has gotten me to where I am today. Is my life fantabulous? No. Actually, it's been pretty shitty lately. But, you know, I call them problems of privilege. You know, my job, plug your ears, sucks. But I have a job. The 5-year-old has been sick over and over and over again. But I have custody of my children. You know, I'm driving out to the doctor. The check engine light is on in my car. But I have a car. You know, and if I had not done everything that I did to get to where I'm at right now, I wouldn't, A, be standing here, or B, have what I have today. You know, I married in this fellowship, and he would be really upset if I didn't mention him, because he always says, "Did you mention me?" No, I love him dearly. Yeah. You know, I now have that house. I now have that family that I always wanted when I was little. And it's only because of this fellowship and working the steps. You know, we work very hard on our sobriety. He works his program, I work mine. We may make suggestions to one another, but we stay out of each other's way, you know. And it's a beautiful thing, you know. We've got, yeah, we've got life's issues, but hey, you know, we're sober. And I have yet to find a reason, you know. And honestly, I haven't even, I mean, the thought of taking a drink doesn't even cross my mind anymore, you know. And I pray every day that that stays that way. I mean, it's not, you know, I'm sober today. Tomorrow's a whole nother day, but I only have today. I can worry about and fret about, but I've only got today, and I've learned through the years and through working these steps and hanging out a little bit here that, you know what, today's a beautiful thing. I take my crappiest day sober than my best day drunk, because there weren't very many good days then. But, you know, I want to thank Stephanie, and it was kind of a payback thing. And I know I made her a little nervous, but the Easter Bunny had to finish her shopping. But I want to thank everybody, keep coming back. It works. Thank you.